Okay, now I have a very serious question. It's so, so serious. People want to know if Bolo survived. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Geek Peek. Today, I am interviewing Brennan Lee Mulligan about Exandria Unlimited Calamity. This is a republished version with pro editing of the original video from YouTube. Before we head into it, wherever you are watching or listening to this interview, please click the subscribe button and show that platform that you love this, if you love this. And without further ado, enjoy the interview. I think the first question that we are all wondering, even before I get to fan questions, is what's the inspiration behind this season?
That's an amazing question. Okay, so the inspiration behind this season came from a conversation that I had been having. You know, I've known Matt and Marisha for many years. Last fall, I had a great, you know, I was talking with Matt and Travis and just, you know, shooting the breeze and talking about, wouldn't it be cool to work on something together? And during that conversation, Matt, who has built this incredible, beautiful, expansive fantasy world, mentioned the areas of the lore that had not yet been explored. And he was like, this is what's so fun about bringing in other dungeon masters into Exandria Unlimited, like Abria Iyengar, who had gone before me, and sort of this vision that Matt had for bringing in other GMs to help run stuff, was to explore these things that are harder to explore in the context of their main campaign series. And he brought straight up, mentioned the Age of Arcanum, this like incredible piece of lore. And for me, you know, doing Dimension 20, which is, you know, amongst D&D shows, really focuses on being a short form anthology. Even our long campaigns are 20 episodes, right? You know, they come out once a week for four and a half months, whatever, right? 5 months. So within that context, listening to what he wanted to explore and knowing that they wanted to do a shorter run for their EXUs, that those parameters kind of inspired the thought of Calamity, of like, what is a moment in Exandria's history that can kind of only be told in short form, right? I don't think you'd want to spend 150 episodes exploring, you know, the coming of ruin, right? Tragedies kind of work better in shorter narrative form, right? And especially because, you know, I think the idea of one age moving into another was just very dramatic. It felt like there was a really rich moment there that felt both horrifying and like there were parts of it that were speaking just to a kind of dread that people feel a lot these days, and kind of talking about something ideal for the format that would be exciting to play in and that would play to the strengths of what they are trying to do with EXU.
Okay. So let me ask you this. How much freedom did you have in what you told, the story you decided to tell with the friends around the table?
A terrifying amount of freedom. I had so much more freedom than people realize. It was nuts. It was Critical Role could not have been more supportive. They really, you know, their parameters were kind of these very big tentpole, you know, world building things, right? We know the calamity has to happen. There's a couple of historical events that need to unfold in a certain way, but you know, those were barely even restrictions. That was kind of just like the broad structure of that historical period, and who the PCs were, what Avalir was going on at the time. you know, we added a lot. And even with the things that were pre-established was this tremendous freedom to add context and add a little bit of ambiguity and have us learn some new things. So I would say that Critical Role gave an astounding amount of support and freedom, even to the extent where I was, you know, I was probably checking in the most of like, is this good? Does this work? I can change any of it, to just enthusiastic smiles and big thumbs up from the awesome team over there. They were great.
Okay. I know it was like so... seeing you like GM this campaign was so much fun. And there were like a lot of moments. For example, you saying, is it Thursday yet? This was like, okay. So tell me a little bit about the experience of filming a campaign in the world of Critical Role and being around that table.
It was unreal. You know, I started... Before I was an actual play creator, I was watching Critical Role. So it's a wild thing. It's a, you know, to be at that table playing with their incredible cast and then some, you know, Dimension 20 luminaries as well. And the amazing Luis Carrazzo, who is so wow. Talented and amazing. And yeah, those little rituals, right? Like ending with, is it Thursday yet? Or doing the pre-intro, tonight's episode of Critical Role into, you know, and also very funny to not do the Dimension 20 rituals, to not say like say hi, Intrepid Heroes, and just be like, don't say hi, Intrepid Heroes, right? Like,
yes.
You know, so it's, changing up the sign-offs was very fun. But you do, I feel like there is a, it was humbling and awe-inspiring and very staggering, not least of which because, you know, we have had Game Masters come into Dimension 20 before. And when Game Masters come into Dimension 20, we're there supporting them. So, you know, I've been on the other side of the process where you're opening up, you know, we open up the dome to people. But we have always opened up the dome to people to come in and do a brand new never before seen season with brand new never before seen characters and worlds and to, you know, what Critical Role is doing, what Matt in particular is doing, by letting people really add canon to Exandria is something that was really breathtaking and felt as a deep act of trust. There's a lot of trust there. So both interacting with the show Critical Role and then the setting of Exandria were very meaningful for different reasons.
Amazing. There's so much like the people around this table, Lou, Luis, Abria, Sam Riegel, Marisha Ray, all of these people. It was such a wild ride. Now, I do want to take you like to fan questions because a lot of them already like go into the questions that I wanted to ask too. So better to have them from audience member. How do you tell when a scene that's focusing on one PC has gone on long enough and you should switch to another PC? Those swaps to Serit when he was off by himself felt so well timed.
Wow, thank you for the compliment to the fan who asked this question. How do you tell? Well, you know, that's really to taste. I'm sure there's people... I have split parties in a lot of my games, cutting back and forth between different scenes. It really messes with verisimilitude if you unorganically force people to always be in a group of six people. That just is not how life works a lot of the time. And there are also certain kinds of scenes that can't happen in a big group, right? Sometimes people only say certain things if they're in certain combinations of people. So for storytelling reasons, I like to have people come together and split off and come together and split off and come together. In terms of when to ring that bell, it's a great question. Unfortunately, I think the answer is pretty instinctual at this point. But of course, instincts honed over a lifetime of doing this. So I can't describe how, but I can describe the what, which is you're kind of feeling an antsiness at the table, right? You're feeling an antsiness at the table of like, maybe other people want to go, or we've been here a little while and something else. And not only are you feeling sometimes you're not only feeling the desire to leave the scene you're currently in, but in Sarah's case, sometimes you're feeling the need to go somewhere that you are not, where you go like, okay, we've been away from Sarah for an hour or 80 minutes, even though we're still in the heart of the action, even though a lot of stuff is still going on, we cannot have a piece off the board for this long, right? And those are very instinctual feelings. They're emotional, kind of. There's not an intellectual aspect to it. It's very much a feeling, for me at least.
Okay. You know what you're talking about. This is a lifetime of experience. I totally get it. Also, I did want to ask, how was it to record such long episodes? Like the finale was 6 hours.
Yes. Well, we record 2 episodes a day in Dimension 20 and 2 talkbacks a day, right? So the timing of everything was very interesting. Yeah, obviously much longer episodes, right? I think that you are, how do I put this? The only way to avoid chunky episodes, in my experience, is to effectively have the only way to avoid chunky episodes, in my experience, is to not have a set number of episodes, right? To in other words, that you are just making episodes as they come and will eventually wrap up when it's right. But if you have a set number of episodes, almost always you either come in a little bit under or a little bit over. Right, it's just very hard to land that plane perfectly accurately. And I remember with Calamity, there were a couple of surprises and things that threw me that I knew. Okay, our last 2 episodes are going to be chunky. They're going to be very. We're going to have a lot of extra material here because the PCs have made decisions that honestly were very optimal for them, but have increased the amount of interactions that we are now going to have. One thing the PCs did that added more time was survive. They lived. PCs lived. So, you know, they didn't die in a lot of the other battles, and they did smart, good stuff that saved their lives. So that's going to add time if you're not dropping some people on the way. Yes, that would be my answer, is that it's very, and it, but those longer episodes, you know, they felt totally natural. It just felt like recording 2 Dimension 20 episodes back to back, you know, like the break in the middle is sort of our, you know, like episode break almost, right? Like that intermission is kind of like, and if you even look at the episodes, like I often do have like little cliffhangers right at the break or something like that. So, you know.
Oh.
So they're almost, to me, it's almost like an 8-episode series, you know, like.
Yeah, the fireworks thing that you did twice was so much funny.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I wanted to remind people. I was kept being like, "This, it's a party. This is like New Year's Eve, you know, like an even more intense New Year's Eve." So, yes, 100%.
That was so funny. This is a great question here. If you were a Calamity player rather than a DM, what kind of person do you think you'd want to play?
Oh, automaton. Easy. I want to be a magic robot. I want to be a magic robot. Obviously, in Matt's world, you know, Aeor rather than Avalir is the city that. But again, assuming I'm a player, kind of makes me assume that Matt is running it, and that it might be set in Aeor, where it would make more sense to be an Aeormaton or something like that. But yeah, let me be a magic robot, either a very sweet magic robot who's trying to do the right thing, or maybe, if we're playing Calamity, a somewhat evil magic robot. Ooh, that'd be fun. Sort of Ultron-y. Ooh. You know what I mean? Someone who maybe sides with the Betrayer Gods because there's some weird computerized logic to wanting to do that. That'd be fun.
That's amazing. Now that Brennan has GM'd in Exandria, when we will get our other dream of a Brennan guest appearance in Critical Role's main campaign world?
Oh, well, that's very, very sweet. I have no idea. I don't know. It is not something I would ever ask for, because they have so many amazing people that they want to play with and that should go and play with them. And you know, I feel at this point I've done a one shot with them and I ran an EXU. I feel like, man, I have already gotten so much more than I ever thought I would. So I am, I wake up every day feeling very satisfied. I feel like I've gotten everything I need. That said, if Matt gave me a call, I'd be there. I'd have like a Wile E. Coyote dust silhouette of pew, and I'd be there. Because it would be amazing to play in that world and to play for Matt. Matt's so incredible. It would be amazing to, you know, sit at that table and just gawk at Matt as perfect fantasy narration comes from his mouth. Yeah, it'd be great.
Okay, now I have a very serious question. It's so, so serious. People want to know if Bolo survived.
We did reference her in the last episode, okay? She did not fall off the planet. We referenced her. There was a possibility of her coming back, and Loquacious shut it down, I would argue rightfully. I don't know that the tone of the finale could have survived Bolo's reappearance. Headcanon, let's see here. What happened to Bolo? In my mind, I think Bolo survives. I think Bolo survives the fall of Avalir. There's a couple reasons for this. Either Bolo was an Aeorian spy and in the chaos stole some wild artifact from the Septarian and like helixed out of there or something like that. Pew! Or Bolo was a polymorphed great worm dragon and is immune to fire damage and was actually in disguise as a person, and when everything popped off was just like, oh damn, and was totally unhurt and flew out of the rubble. Either way, you know, I'm good with it. I think Bolo definitely makes it out for sure. Long live Bolo.
You heard it here first. Amazing. Okay. And people want to know, okay, let's see. Yes, this is the one. Did you always plan on Asmodeus, I'm probably mispronouncing his name, being the betrayer god that the party would interact with? Or did you consider any others to be the face of the betrayer gods?
It was always going to be Asmodeus, and I can tell you why. As much as I like Asmodeus and was just sort of drawn to that betrayer god, there's also in the lore, Vespin Chloris is at the right hand, is rumored to be at the right hand of the Lord of the Hells, right? So there's an element of wanting to explain that piece of the lore. Because the legend is always Vespin Chloris released the betrayer gods, but then they say he's at the right hand of Asmodeus. And so there's a part of me that's like, okay, well, what's the... In other words, like, yeah, he released them all, but clearly there's a special relationship here. There's something here that warrants explaining. So for me, I was like, I knew I wanted to have Asmodeus be kind of the face of the betrayers. Number one, because amongst the betrayers, he's one of the few that has trickery as a domain, right? So he's like a good, you know, he's the probably like, if the betrayer guys were an adventuring party, Asmodeus would be the bard or the sorcerer. You know, he'd be the one who could like talk to people. And that it would explain his connection with Vespin Chloris, that Vespin went for him specifically. And then that's how he was able to manipulate and crack the seal and, you know, have everything happen that happens.
Okay. And like Asmodeus, wow, I'm going to really botch this name.
I love it. You're getting it right, Asmodeus.
Asmodeus. Yeah. Okay, great. So, was he like, how was it that you, did you think about the relationship between him and Luis from the beginning? Or was this like something that you felt was developing organically as you started Calamity?
Luis? So in shorter campaigns, I rely really heavily on player backstory and collaborating with them about how they feel about their characters. And Luis wanted, you know, Luis and me emailed a ton back and forth. Luis is awesome. He is any DM's dream player. He thinks so richly and deeply about his character. He writes his character in a way so that the character is multifaceted and has conflict. You know, like if you read Luis's breakdowns of who Xerxes is a grieving husband. He is a devoted father. He is a proud servant, but also deeply dislikes the city and culture that he has devoted himself to. And then on top of that, all of that is in conflict with this deep philosophical turmoil that he's in, where he has thoughts about divinity and the gods and the nature of Exandria and the cosmos. And is very vulnerable, right? He's a conflicted guy, very strong in combat, but devastated by grief, separated from his only living family member, and then the kind of person with like very deep convictions, but without a lot, but like an ability to almost like obsess or tunnel vision on them, right? That's a really rich character and incredibly lovingly detailed to the point where you're like, all of this person's strengths and flaws make perfect sense to me. It is a perfectly unified person that is still in conflict with themselves, right? In his backstory was like, my character thinks a lot about the betrayer gods, meditates on the betrayer gods, has a lot of thoughts about the betrayer gods, wonders about them, studies all religious stuff about them. And I literally was there because none of the other characters were interested in the gods, but I knew how important the gods had to be for this chapter in history. So I was like, you don't say, you're very interested in the betrayer gods. And so it was the easiest yes and in the world for a guy who's like, hey, I'm playing a character who's obsessed with the betrayers and is also not doing great. And I was like, awesome. Awesome. Perfect. Got. Hey, man, I got you. And so everything was just developed. Luis didn't have any advanced knowledge of what was going to happen, but he was such a pro with his character that I was like, okay, this guy is who Asmodeus would target to get into the world. Powerful paladin who's kind of antagonistic to the powers that be and to the prime deities, who's very lonely and isolated. Yeah, that's who, if you're the devil, that's who you're going to pick as like, that's my guy, right? So it was always going to happen that way.
You're my best champion.
You're my best champion. Well, who's more proud than Xerxes? Xerxes has the most hubris of anybody in the world. So that's, you know, like, and what does the Lord of the Hells love more than pride? He's like, that's my guy. This guy thinks he can do anything. So there you go.
Amazing. Okay. Next question here is another fun one for you. What's your favorite NPC from The Calamity?
Favorite NPC from The Calamity. Bolo has a special place in my heart always. Really enjoyed.
True story. This question is actually like someone asked the question and someone else commented below that. And why is it Bolo?
I just have to say thanks to Sam Riegel. What a great gift. What a great gift. I've brought a plus one and her name is Bolo. Perfect. Perfect. Weirdly, the ones that popped ahead, Asmodeus also, I just love a good villain. You know, and Asmodeus is very fun because he's so pure. He's a divinity, right? He's like a facet of the cosmos. So there's things that are deeply human about him, and there's things that are deeply inhuman about him. And it's fun to play the mixture of the two, right? Then I would say I really loved playing Sarit's kids. I really loved Kier and Maya.
Wow.
They were great to like ground the game in something real. I was really glad that Travis had a family, because without Travis there, you know, everyone just sort of becomes bystanders, right? They're sort of like the idea of like, here's some people that are truly powerless and are at stake and don't get a say in what happens to the world, and they matter too, right? So playing Kier and Maya was really special. And then off the top of my head, I'll stop here. I just really also liked Pharamine the Sphinx, a minor bit character. Wow. And I also really liked Alessandre. I liked Lou's little candle hat bookkeeper. The idea of being just like an old, tired accountant in a city of mages. I just really dug, you know, a little voice of reality in a city of wonders was like very fun to play too.
I really loved Lou's character. Like, every time I play any RPG game that has me, like, choosing races and stuff, mm-hmm. I will always go for the Dragonborn. It's like a thing.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Well, he was great, too. It's such an interesting thing with Lou, because obviously he's playing a human variant, but he's playing a draconic sorcerer. And it's always so interesting to think about that idea of, like, oh, like, and like with Nidus, you don't really get to get into it because Nidus's power comes so much from his institution and his position. And like, you know, when we meet Nidus, his days are not full of spell casting or sword play. They're full of skill checks. Like, that's what the guy's doing all day. He's a CEO. He's a boss, right? He's like running around doing that stuff. And then you suddenly see it's like, oh no, this is like a very innately magical, powerful, and also just how good Lou is at implying a backstory, right? Where you're like, this guy had sorceress blood, but was born in a poor dock town and joined a pirate crew and quickly rose up the ranks because he's goddamn magic. And he's this magic pirate captain. And then, you know, it's great. I loved Nidus. What a golden heart at the end. I could never have seen that coming. The fact that I've been playing with Lou Wilson for so many years and he still shocks me with the power and the unexpected things he does with his characters in the best way. Because it's like, it's unexpected, but it's also the only thing that makes sense. And that takes a pro to do that. It's incredible.
I also want to say, like, if you go back and watch, like, the terrifying moments from like, you know, the reveal of like Luis's relationship with Asmodeus, mm-hmm. Then like if you only look at Lou while this is unfolding, it's the most hilarious thing ever because Lou knows your shit.
Yeah, exactly. Face in hands, or just him looking and being like, don't do it, man. Don't do it. Don't do it. I love it. Lou's blowing up my spot. I gotta put like a Venetian blind around him at tables. Because if people watch Lou, they can tell what I'm up to. So, you know, gotta be careful in the future. Funny.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask, there was like after the finale aired, you tweeted that Abria is the kind of player around the table that knows the assignment or something. And I don't remember your exact words.
Yes.
I want to flip that. What would you have done if nobody understood the assignment and just tried to survive? Like,
well,
what would have happened?
We would have had a way worse story. I mean, that's the reality, right? It's like something would have happened and it would have been way less cool, way less meaningful, way less badass. You know, like if I had six players that didn't understand the assignment, right, then probably we start episode one and they all metagame and go, the calamity's about to happen. We got to stop it. You know, right? Which is metagaming at that point, because what the hell is the calamity? And you can see my favorite thing in episode one is that there are clues that things are going bad, but you see the PCs kind of not go into top gear right away, which is very realistic, right? They're like, well, how bad is it? Is it really bad? You know, like, and kind of drag their feet a little bit. Not until we get way into it. Not until, like, spoilers, but not until, like, Akami Ro is murdered are people, like, hustling. Hustling, right?
Yes.
But within that, I would say, you know, again, spoilers, if Laren doesn't cast Blight, if Xerxes doesn't reach out to Asmodeus, if these people don't do these kind of, like, if Sarit doesn't leave, to go get his kids, right? Like, all these choices are so beautiful and so real and so true to the characters and make so much sense. If they don't do those things, then probably what happens is, you know, they do the ritual to bring Vespin Chloris through with the stuff they gathered from Orwyn. They turn the taxmen. Vespin and the taxmen come in, not to the astral lay rite, but to the arboreal calyx. And rather than trying to defend Laren for three rounds, it's a much harder situation of the taxmen jump in and Vespin is gonna drop some kind of spell of destruction on the tree. And then probably the tree goes down because it's way harder to defend a tree than it is to defend a powerful like wizard, right? And there's not a three round limit on that fight. So it's just knock down, drag out for as long as it takes. Within that world, right? I would say, you know, the tree comes down, and then what's the moral of that story? Duh, man, this bad wizard blew up the tree. Which is sort of, you know, it would have been okay. It would have been okay. Yeah. You know, it would have been like, oh, man, we couldn't stop him. But what we got was so much more interesting than that. So that's what I meant when I said that Abria understood the assignment, is it's way more interesting to have the PCs be vastly more culpable for the destruction of the Tree of Names, for the entry of Asmodeus into Exandria. It's way more interesting to have them be culpable for that than it is to have that be something that they were just trying to stop and couldn't.
Oh, this is one of the most amazing questions ever. Were there any significant missed clues or alternate paths the players could have taken?
1,000,000%. There were so many. I thought that they might go to the Septarian. I thought they might tell other mages in the city about what was going. There was a whole plot thread around the Septarian and around, Loras of the Weaver's mask, but you know, they, for the most part, they just handled business themselves and did not make any reports to like other factions within the city. So that was a big, like, not, I don't think they missed any clues, but that was a big part of it. The disanimated Hod Madad obviously like didn't get figured out until the very end. That could have gotten figured out sooner. And then Elena Tuveris never that came out only at the very end, the whole thing there. And of course, you know, there was a world where I thought there was going to be potentially way more PvP. Like, if Xerxes had found out under different circumstances what had happened with Evandrin, if it had not been Laren to tell, you know, like, things could have gone down very differently, for sure. But the PCs kind of kept it together for the most part and did not turn on each other. Except, you know, there was friction, but no true, like, you know, combat, not any physical conflict. So yeah, that was very surprising to me.
Amazing. What was your favorite improvised moment of the show?
What just leapt to my mind was Lou Wilson going, summoning the dragon and being like, shut the fuck up, we don't have time.
That's so cool. I love that moment.
So good. I love Lou so much. That was such a good moment. Yeah, that was incredible. One of my favorite non-improvised moments was the incredible speech that Sam wrote in that final episode. Holy smokes, was that amazing. That was just so, so beautiful. Abria's line, my best, finally. That's maybe the most heartbreaking piece of dialogue I've ever heard. Incredible. My best, finally. Yeah, it was all so, so, so good. It was just so good.
Here's another fun one. What's been the most fun experience working with the Critical Role crew?
Oh, Kyle Shire is a dream. What an incredible man. So on the ball. Danny Carr, the lore keeper, was absolutely delightful. Shout out to all the folks at the studio, to Jerry and all the amazing PAs and camera and producers and sound, and just unbelievable. And of course to Matt, you know, like truly coming into the studio, he's such a good set builder, which of course, due to the fabulous Rick Perry, is something that I don't need to do. And I say need to do, something that I probably can't do very well. I don't need to do it. I can't do it at all. Only Rick can do it. And I don't even try to. But Matt's great at it. So going in early in the morning and helping him with that was very, very fun.
What's the challenges of DMing a small campaign versus a long one? And what changes in the preparation and pacing? How do you manage them differently?
The preparation and the pacing. The shorter something is, the more preparation it needs. In a weird way. Because when something is longer, preparation becomes less useful. If you're going to play 150 episodes, how are you going to prepare for episode 140? At the beginning, what do you mean you're prepping for 140 episodes from now, right? Something that's four episodes, you got to know. And for Dimension 20, we have to like build our battle sets ahead of time. We got to do a bunch of stuff and stay really on the rails. Also, there's an asterisk on your question, which is this campaign for your players? Or is it an actual play? In which case, it's for your players and for the audience at home. Right? I have played some really amazing games that didn't have an ending. Like the campaign fizzled out or we didn't go, like whatever. But my experiences of playing, I still have and treasure, right? Still enjoyed my character. Audiences, I don't think, react the same way. If you give an audience half a story, they're going to be like, what the hell, man? You know, case in point, Game of Thrones, right? Like, it's not good to not give a good ending. The ending matters.
Yes.
So that's what you're preparing for in a shorter campaign is this idea, and especially if you have a fixed number of episodes. if someone's like, here are the dates, the plane has to, it's like landing an airplane. It's like, this is as much runway as you have, figure it out. And so that's why the preparation becomes important, is because you have to make something. It's not just hang time with the buds. It is, this needs to work, it needs to stick, it needs to be satisfying, it needs to mean something, and it needs to do that in 4 episodes. So in those contexts, a lot more preparation is needed. But if you're running a one-shot for your pals at home, I don't think that pressure is as high. You can always just go like, hey, like this ran long. Can people do it again next week? But in actual play, the stakes are very different.
Talking about endings, I think we have reached the ending of this amazing conversation. I love you so much.
Love you too.
And thank you so much for this conversation. Please tell people of the world what you want to tell them about Calamity, and please finish your outro with, is it Thursday yet?
Folks, if you want to check out Calamity, the entire thing is up on VOD on Critical Role's YouTube channel. All 4 episodes are there. Come check it out. We're doing a wrap up that should be coming out in not too long as well. That'll be really awesome. You can find me and my stuff at Brendan LM on Twitter, at Brendan Lee Mulligan on Instagram. Check out at Dimension 20 Show. We have a YouTube channel and a Twitter, and go to dropout.tv if you want to sign up to watch all of the Dimension 20. What I'll say to you now, Oren, is it Thursday yet? Not yet. Not while we're recording this. It might be Thursday while you're watching this, but right now, at the moment of recording, it's not Thursday yet. But we want to know if it is Thursday yet.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Geek Peek. I hope you enjoyed. And before I let you go, I want to thank the individuals who went the extra mile and became my patrons. So, thank you so much to Arthur Morrill, Bob Prescott, Lexi Gardner, Cody Neville, Charlie Fisher, Stoat Dross, Laura Hamilton, Maggie, and Grace Bauer. If you want to join them, head on over to patreon.com/TheOrenCohen. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye for now.